I think that this is for the tape recorder. Can you hear me? Patricia? This evening is the observance night, and then with Susan and Marlene taking the Anagarika precepts. This Anagarika is going away from the home life, the security of and the safety of the what's usually considered, what we depend on, to the holy life. The eight precepts is a willingness to live within the limits set by these precepts, and remaining respectful for life and being responsible for what we do and what we say. The last five are restraining on behavior in order to pinpoint or reflect our worldly attitudes around eating, or the last three anyway, the around eating or sleeping, or our ways of entertaining ourselves, distracting ourselves through playing games and seeking entertainments, all the pleasures, dancing, singing, and so forth that the world enjoys, then under these precepts we're refraining from seeking distraction in those ways. And the point, of course, is to give this assistance towards just observing how we distract ourselves. As a lay life or ordinary life is really an attempt to seek happiness and to avoid pain and to get away from anything that is unpleasant or painful, unwanted. And so in modern life especially, the stress factors are so strong because there's the abilities to distract yourself are so sophisticated with all the high tech television and so forth, the websites and the computers, and it's one could just live one's life solely in kind of involving oneself in these kind of distractions. Just seeking pleasure, exciting things to do, is quite normal in anybody's life. But then the life of an Anagarika is now the willingness. This is, they've asked for these precepts. This is their request to live under these restraints, and this is to develop mindfulness. Now, the precepts are, in Buddhism, are not kind of like condemnations of pleasure. And they're not against dancing, singing, or eating meals in the afternoon, or sleeping on luxurious beds. And it's not like we're condemning or banning these kind of practices, or seeing them in any negative way. But it's a voluntary approach to allow us to live a very simple life, to simplify our lives, because life tends to get very complicated. we can see in modern society how much of it is, the fact that there is so much stress in the society is because people do not have any time to sit and be still, because this is to be developed patience and stillness and silence and meditation. I remember when I was a child back in the 40s, there was always this sense of modern technology would make us live our lives in the future in a way that we could really enjoy them, all the tedious things that we had to do would be done by machinery or by robots, and that we'd be free to just enjoy and have a good time. And this was the great hope, or the idea then was to have a life of complete and utter comfort. So I kind of imagine this armchair that was very, very comfortable, and all you had to do the rest of your life was sit in it and push buttons, and then whatever you wished, you'd get immediately. You wouldn't have to wait 2 seconds for it. And all the house cleaning, the dishwashing, cooking, everything would be done in a way that you wouldn't have to bother to get yourself to get up out of this wonderfully comfortable armchair. And you could just sink into it and watch movies and eat whatever you desired and drink whatever you wanted for the rest of your life, this kind of childlike dream of paradise. It's interesting to see as this becomes more and more the way things are, the more stress we create. And so people then find out just sitting in comfortable chairs for too long gives you other problems. And your physical body starts deteriorating, and all kinds of ailments come from eating delicious food and not exercising. So now we find, in affluent countries like this one, people now spending hours doing the most rigorous exercises. and going on diets and so forth to protect their health or to get to be fit is the ideal. But no matter how fit you become and so forth, it's still the mental, the mind, the consciousness that's really the important one. So in the Buddha established his teaching, it was this as the Majjhima Matibhata, the middle way. Or it's not the extreme of comfort, and Gama Sukhalikanu Yoga is the Pali word in the Tamajaka Sutta for just living in luxury and comfort, and Attakilamatanu Yoga is the other extreme of asceticism, of denial. This attack on the pleasures and happiness and sensual world as something you've got to deny and reject and protect yourself from is the other extreme. So then when we reflect that this is not this monastic life is not attakilamatanu yoga, it's not an attempt to deny or repress, because we see all desires and all pleasures and all happiness as some kind of danger to our spiritual path. But it's finding a balance and being able to observe the way things are, having a simple life based on moral precepts. And then morality is a word that in the Western mind tends to be rather threatening, because it implies kind of that making moral judgments or value judgments about behavior, and then this idea of commandments of rather than precepts, we call them rules, moral rules, or or commandments. In other words, they're kind of imposed on us. We're the old kind of Victorian morality that we rebelled against. What we generally refer to as Victorian morality was a kind of hypocrisy, because it was very much kind of telling us how we should behave, and then threatening us with hellish torments and pain and retribution if we didn't. So there's this attitude of morality being imposed on us through intimidation, and we're trying to be good because we're afraid of being bad, being punished. Or in the Buddhist sense of sila, then these are not commandments. These are not, you know, something that God is telling you how you should behave. It's not coming from above as some kind of order that in order to be approved of and to be rewarded, you must be good. But it is their standards of speech and behavior, physical behavior, that we ask. We, like you, the Susan and Marlene, asked to take these 8 precepts. They requested them, and according to the Vinaya, the monastic discipline, we're not supposed to, we can't impose them. We can't go around saying, you've got to take the 8 precepts, and then kind of force them on somebody. It's always this request 3 times that they ask, and then we can offer these precepts. Now, precepts then are standards that we use in order to observe our own behavior. And so, like the first one of Banadibata is non-violence. In our life here in a monastery, we can refine this precept to the idea of respecting life in all its forms. So we vow not to intentionally take the life of other creatures, which include flies, mosquitoes, on up to human beings. So this is a matter of intention also. We're not acting upon maybe a feeling of annoyance and aversion to something where we just automatically try to destroy that which irritates. But it stops us from acting in that way. Like, I remember in my years as a monk, the 13 years I didn't go home. And when I went home, my father was swatting flies in the kitchen. You know, so he had this fly swatter, and he'd go around killing these flies. And I sat there quite appalled, thinking, what a cruel old man, my father. Where at one time I would have rejoiced when he got one and say, good for you, you got him. But then the attitude of the samana changes you to where you're no longer thinking that flies no longer have the right to exist, you know. So it's a kind of respect for life that one develops through reflection, not as a commandment that you have to do it, but it comes through just observing these kind of violent tendencies that one has. How when we're frustrated, irritated, like with insect world, how, you know, the worldly life is very much based on getting rid of, annihilating these things as quickly as possible. And we can observe that mental state, you know. And in my own practice, I observe that a lot, living in Thailand, where they have so many insects and annoying creatures, that you feel this aversion and irritation and wanting to get rid of them, to annihilate them, to get them out as quickly as possible, because they're bothering me. they're upsetting me. But then with reflection and awareness of your mental state, I could see, you know, this attitude of those mosquitoes are causing me to suffer, or as Lung Pa Cha always was pointing out, or are we making ourselves suffer because of the mosquitoes? So we, you know, it's easy to blame the mosquito, but is that really what's going on? You know, is that mosquito really the problem, or am I creating the suffering by hating, resenting the presence of the mosquito? So this is a reflection, isn't it? This is a way of questioning and beginning to recognize, you know, the habit tendencies that we have, the worldly habits and attitudes and assumptions we make through our worldly conditioning. Once I could see the suffering I created around mosquitoes and ants and termites and snakes, and I could relinquish this suffering. I could let go of the causes of suffering. And in that way, a sense of respect for life increased quite naturally, without kind of sentimentalizing it or idealizing this idea of respect for life. It is quite natural to us when we see how that the suffering of our life is generated through our own ignorance, rather than always blaming somebody else or something else. So then it's developing panya, or wisdom. We're learning. So the second precept, this respect for property. And now with the kind of ecological movement and concern for the environment and so forth, it's become worldwide, because we have not developed much respect for the world that we live in. Even though on its most kind of obvious level, Ajahn does not to steal things, take things that don't belong to us, for us we're expanding this kind of precept into respect for the environment. We can expand it to that, to learning how to live with nature, the environment we're in a respectful way, and not take it for granted and abuse it, misuse it, or neglect it, or in ways that we would tend to do, maybe if we didn't really have a precept to work from, to remind us. In a monastery like this, it'll respect the places we live in, the temple, and then the actual land that we live on, and the country that we're living in. It's all part of this developing a sense of responsibility, of learning how to live in a way that is not just heedless, thoughtless, disrespectful, uncaring, but learning how to be aware of how we might be doing these things without really intending to. How our worldly conditioned mind can just take things for granted and never really observe how we treat the places we live in, or the property that belongs to somebody else. Then the Brahmacharya precept around sexuality. So this is a celibate lifestyle. Simplifies things, because we choose to live this way and not to seek sexual experiences. Now this is a very strong drive that is very natural to this realm that we're living in. Our human bodies are sexual bodies, so that they're made for sexual intercourse, reproduction, things like this. So this is, and so people question the validity of a brahmacharya. But then we can see that sexuality that has never any boundaries on it leads to all kinds of other problems. And so many societal problems now from not being responsible for our own sexual feelings in our own bodies. So we become carried away by just pleasure seeking or exploiting our own bodies or taking advantage of others without feeling anything, without being responsible or considering what we're doing, because a lust, sexual desire can be such a strong energy that it can make us very heedless. So refraining from intentional sexual acts is not a condemnation of sexuality. It's not that we regard it as dirty or bad or something inferior, but it is learning how to live with the sexual energies in a way that because we've refrained from acting on them, then we can be aware of them as they actually happen to us, arise and cease. And we can transcend, we can be free from our own habitual tendencies in that direction, and free from the fear of those kind of energies, or just the blind lust that takes us over if we're not mindful. So this is developing awareness. As you reflect, you begin to see how complicated we've made our own sexuality at this time. It's no longer just simple procreative urge and that, but it's now become such a complicated and highly fraught issue in every way that it's much more than it really is. And it can be either glorified to more than what it really is, or it can be completely rejected or despised. But the middle way is the awareness of the way things are. And developing this mindfulness and awareness is the main purpose of our life, to begin to realize this also very natural ability that we all have as human beings to pay attention and learn and observe how things actually are. The fourth is around speech, mutsawada, and learning to use speech in the right way. How to use what we say in a way that is not giving confused messages or distorted meanings. How to not abuse others or use language that offends or insults or demeans other people. So we have to be aware of how to use speech that leads towards understanding, towards harmony, towards respect. And of course, we're having these NVC workshops and things like this these days, because this is a problem with us in the monastic communities. Oftentimes, we don't speak to each other in skillful ways. And I just watch myself in my own kind of, just my habitual ways of speaking, how aggressive I can sound, or blaming my speech can be without really intending it to be that way, but just because the speech patterns are there or the conditioning is like that. So it is an attempt now to even cultivate a more skillful way of thinking and of speaking, being responsible for how we say things, so that we can avoid unnecessary, complicated situations, misunderstandings, especially in a multicultural community like we have here. I mean, it's so easy to misunderstand each other because of some of us are, you know, like I'm an American, so how Americans speak is quite different from the British. Can be a lot of misunderstanding just around American English and British English. And then those of you who had to learn English from as a second language and so forth, this, we can all be kind of frustrated and easily misunderstanding each other's motives or intentions just because of the way we talk or say things. So learning, I think speech is one of the more difficult ones. Because remember when I first ordained, how whenever I got a chance to speak English, you kind of blurt out things. It's so easy to fall back into old patterns of speech and oftentimes very careless ways of talking that were quite all right or quite, normal in my lay life, but which were not appropriate in monastic life. And the fifth one about refraining from addictive drugs and alcoholic drinks that change consciousness, that affect us. Because where the important thing is, you know, some people have taken various drugs where they have very kind of mystical experiences because they see things in a way they wouldn't ordinarily see them, these hallucinogenic drugs. And I remember years ago we all used to hope that LSD would be the quick way to enlightenment. We just had to spend $5 on a tablet and you're enlightened. That'd be a lot easier than going to India and covering myself with ashes and hanging upside down from a tree. Or sitting for hours on a zafu, you know, with painful knees or so forth. It'd be so convenient to just be able to take a pill and then enlightened forever. That was the big hope. But that didn't really wasn't the way it is. That's not the way it is. So this changing consciousness, like trying to, even though you can have very kind of strong, kind of seemingly mystical experiences, the consciousness is not, you're not working from a consciousness that is uninfluenced by the drugs. And the whole point of our practice then is to learn how to develop from the consciousness that is not highly distorted through drugs or drink. You're wanting to even if you're even if so much of your attitude, your way you think, your emotional habits are negative or inadequate, we need to start from where we are rather than just trying to bypass all that and get rid of it then through some easy, quick way. But it's learning to be patient and learning how to be and accept the conditions that we're experiencing, whether they're physical or emotional. Then around food and seeking pleasurable entertainments, distractions, and sleeping on high luxurious beds. These are giving limitations on eating, which is a necessity, because we have to eat in order to live, And so the Buddha allowed us to eat. That eating's okay, but then but then you have to, you know, not to go spend the whole day eating, you know. So you know, the bindabhata, he allowed the alms bowl for the monks and bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, and this we could go between dawn and noon and collect food, whatever people were offering. And then we're not to spend the whole day just searching for food, or spend the whole day eating things. So this makes life easy. We don't have to, we really don't have to think about food that much. Here in England, it's also kind of laid on. I went on Bindabad last Saturday, and Bookham said that was very pleasant, actually. To go alms collecting in Berkhamsted, quite a pleasant thing to be able to do. And if I wasn't a Buddhist monk, I would have never thought of it, you know, doing such a thing. But even in a non-Buddhist country, the people that gave us alms, I didn't know a single one of them, never saw them before, but it does arouse this generosity from people that you would never expect them to, you know, feel that they should even. But it's interesting when you're standing on the high street in Berkhamsted how they, you know, some people immediately catch on and will offer. Others just, you know, don't notice it or kind of look at us and ignore us. Or whatever, some just don't want to know or don't care, just think we're crazy. And others, it's quite beautiful how many people do, you know, will kind of sense and appreciate what we're doing and offer. So we had a lot of foods. Honorable Emanato and I, we, more than we could eat. So around food, it's learning too, you know, and seeing, but being aware of our own hang-ups, obsessions around eating, because this is a very, very touchy subject. You know, food, and this can bring up so much anger and aversion, and if we can't get what we want, and we have so many kind of habits, that have never been really consciously noticed or accepted around food. Now sometimes I notice that we get very, like some people get into not eating any food. They think they've got to stop eating or eat very little, and others get well, like today's Donna, I mean, you saw that vast array of incredible food on the server. I'm the type that gets carried away. Others, I think more greedy than averse. But this, but just noticing these tendencies, you know, not to even be critical. I'm not to even criticize and feel guilt, but just to notice the way we respond or react to food, or the guilt we have about it, about eating food. Sometimes, especially Western people, we can feel guilty about being hungry. We get too idealistic about monasticism, and we think we should, we feel guilty if we even enjoy eating food. Because we're easily neurotic, Western people, in this way. Our natural instincts, natural tendencies are not recognized or appreciated. They're taken very personally and criticized. So I've known monks and nuns who can feel guilty about enjoying eating or eating too much or whatever, or incredibly complicated and convoluted in their minds around just the simple act, natural act of eating something. Is food is a necessity, the requisite to life. So this Vikalpochana then isn't a fasting precept. It's not saying you shouldn't eat, you shouldn't enjoy, or condemning eating as something vulgar and that you should be ashamed of it and try to do as little of it as possible. It's not anything like that. If that is attakilamatanu yoga, that's the extreme of asceticism. But it does put limits on when we can eat, so that we're not spending that. That's another way to distract yourself, isn't it? Just nibbling on things all day long. On retreats, and 10-day retreats, and with people, the lay people take the 8 precepts, you know, they like to have their biscuits with them. They can feel a little distressed in the noon time, the afternoon, they can have a biscuit, make you feel good. So just to note that when you put these, take these precepts, then you can notice these, the way the mind will easily seek something for something to do, something comforting or something, just something to do. For those of you that are going on retreats, you know, silent retreats, you know, for me, I notice how on a silent retreat where I don't have to attend the morning pujas, evening pujas, where I eat alone, I'm all by myself, the mind easily looks for something. And it'll bring up all kinds of things to feel guilty about, or that just it's a habit. Because emotionally, we're conditioned to kind of be engaged in things and busy, and when we don't have all those things to keep us going, and we're just left to our own devices, then my mind will keep producing even more things, find anything. And so the liberation is through awareness of this. As you're aware, you begin to see through it. See through all the complicated mental habits that you've acquired. And trusting in, you know, pure awareness, the stillness of the mind as the refuge, rather than endlessly trying to analyze, criticize, make yourself perfect, or endlessly doubt about yourself. You know, see yourself through your critical mind, or through your, through feeling not good enough, or inadequate, or not worthy, and all these mental states then can be seen and witnessed as conditions that you're recognizing, but you're no longer grasping and holding to and letting them take you over. Then the long one, Najakita Watita Vituka, that one, that used to be the test in the old days when the Anagarikas took the precepts. They used to have to do it alone, or we made it easy because all the Anagarikas volunteered, I think, to take. But in the old days, it was a real test whether one could get through Najakita Watita. So when we're waiting for that one, we're all waiting, then the Anagarika, we're waiting to see whether he or she could get through it. And then we'd say, yay! That's quite a mouthful, isn't it, just say, to give up wearing cosmetics, jewelry. Refraining from playing games or dancing or singing. So these are restraints on precepts that help us to see when we get fed up, get tired, and we want to distract ourselves through some kind of pleasurable activity, distracting activity. And then the Ujjayana Mahasayana is about sleep. And you know, it says not high and luxurious beds, it really means not to spend all the time sleeping, because that's another way we get out of looking, out of being mindful and having to bear with things that might be very unpleasant for us, is to fall asleep. So there's sexual activities as a way to distract yourself, or drinking booze, drinking liquor, taking drugs, eating a lot all the time, dancing, singing, entertainments, playing games, doing all kinds of things like that, and then sleeping a lot. These are, they quite, and nowadays these are quite normal ways to live, just seeking these endless distractions, one right after another, through the sensual pleasures. So notice that the limits are there, and not as a moral judgment against, but as precepts, guidelines to remind us and to help us reflect on our own kind of habitual tendencies regarding these conditions. And it's not to judge yourself, like to feel, you know, to condemn yourself for having sexual desires or for wanting to eat food in the afternoon or whatever. It's not like to intimidate you into feeling guilty and unworthy because you have these kind of desires or wishes or feelings, but it's to reflect those feelings so you can see them and accept them and learn from them, rather than just be caught in blindly following them or in repressing them, in rejecting them. But the important thing is the awareness, the awakened state, and really opening to, you know, so that we're really with the moment and we can observe, be in this position of being able to recognize what is happening, the way it is, which is non-judgmental. As soon as you pass a judgment on it, you've lost it. You know, is not making kind of value judgments about what you're feeling, but recognizing the feeling that I have right now is like this. If it's a bad feeling, then saying it's bad, I'm making a value judgment. But we know it's like this, and we know in just that the experience is, you know, painful or bad or whatever, but it's not something we act on. Though it's not a matter of feeling guilty about having this feeling, because our intention is not to act on it. So once you start making some kind of personal judgment about yourself because of what you're thinking or feeling, then you've lost it. You're caught in the trap of your personality, where you tend to make endless criticisms and judgments about yourself because you're not always thinking or feeling the ideal way that you think you should. And then, so we can be incredible tyrants and relentless critics towards ourselves, because we aren't. We can never be as good as we imagine we should be. So I can imagine how good I should be, but the reality is that what I'm feeling right now is like this. And this is what we learn to trust, is this awareness, the feeling, the state of mind, the physical body, the thoughts, or whatever their quality is at this moment. From the awareness, we're totally accepting, recognizing, and admitting them. It's an honest approach. You're not trying to justify or condemn or make any problem about it, but to recognize. So in this way of the Buddha taught of looking at the impermanent nature of conditioned phenomena. That's not a judgment, is it? You're not saying all conditions are impermanent. It's not judging conditions. It's merely noticing. It's a guide towards noticing that conditioned phenomena is in an inexorable process of change. So then we are developing this panya, this wisdom. It comes through awareness, not through critical judgment. Now, there's so many of us that have very critical minds, so that when we make we're so easily led into judging ourselves or others. And then and we can get very self-righteous about it. We can feel, I'm right, he's wrong. And this is, you know, then we do this and we're not aware. Then we can be really deluded through our own sense of being right. And then we think, because I'm right, then it's true. And then this koan of Lungpa Cha is true but not right, right but not true. Because awareness transcends these conditions. And that it embraces right and wrong, good and bad. And we're seeing that all conditions are impermanent, not just the good ones or the bad ones, but all conditioned phenomena, its very nature is changing, is change. Now this means we do this through awareness, not through belief. Now if we grasp this idea that all conditions change, that's not it. We're not here to believe that all conditions are changing. You don't have to believe it. Because it's what the way it is, so you observe it. And that's so that all conditions are impermanent is not a doctrine that we grasp, but just a reminder to look at what we're feeling and thinking, our own bodies, the world that we see or smell, hear, taste, or touch. If we really pay attention, we notice that it's all in this changing, ephemeral state, arising, begins, and ends. So, to encourage you in these precepts are here to be an aid, to be something that supports awareness, not something to delude you. But we can delude ourselves with the precepts. So when you delude yourself with the precepts, then you're taking them very personally, and you're judging yourself all the time about how well or not very well you're keeping the precepts. So I mean, then the precepts become reinforced your delusions about yourself. You know, if you grasp them wrongly, if you can, you know, how pure am I in my precepts? And then we can get into terrible states of feeling intimidated or guilty or not good enough, because are we don't think we're so good as we should be in regards to the precepts. So these tendencies of guilt that we tend to pile onto ourselves can be seen with mindfulness, that this is something we create because we tend to grasp these precepts as some kind of personal thing. My precepts. I am an anagarika. I have to be like this. I've got to prove myself. I have to. And then the whole ego, the sense of yourself, is increased through this wrong grasping of the precepts. So the precepts are taken, and they're taken as something to support awareness. Remember that the whole point of your life here is really to encourage awakened attention, to wake up and observe, rather than try to become the best anagarika or make yourself pure or in some way. But it's learning how to use conventions rather than to just blindly grasp them. This is takes panya, of course, wisdom to learn how to use conventional forms like this in the right way. So tonight is the observance night, and everyone's invited to continue till midnight. And I'll end here.